The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic, much of this week is step 9 of mindfulness of breathing. And this is the step where we're experiencing the mind. And I hope that the way I'm presenting the mind is something that's not, I'm not trying to define it in ways that you have to fit yourself into the definition, but rather that it's pointing to how you experience the mind, the mental state, mind state, heart state, that there's a lot of room here for you to find your own way through this. But one of the ways to appreciate it is that we're moving into the sum total of how we experience the mind. Vipassana practice often has a big emphasis on the particularity, really seeing the particularity of the in-breath, the out-breath, of sensations as they occur, the particular activities of the mind as they come and they go. But there's also some way that part of the particular is also the harmonious working of all this together, or the kind of the awareness or the knowing that knows it all. And exactly whether mind and awareness are the same, knowing is the same or not, it's very hard to kind of pin down these things to know exactly what the mind is or consciousness or all these kinds of things that belong to this rather... I don't know if amorphous is the right word, but difficult to define qualities or experiences of our interiority, of our inner life. And you'll see now in a moment maybe why it's difficult to kind of put words on it and define it exactly, is that the concepts that we live with, the ideas that we have, about our experience actually shapes our experience. We are not innocent bystanders of our experience, that whatever happens to us, whatever experience we're having, that it's only happening to us. We're also contributing to some degree to that experience, that certainly there are clear things that happen to us, so to choose something relatively innocent perhaps, if I go out... I'll give you the example I've taught many times, and I was thinking about it today when I was biking down here. It was cold biking down here this morning. Kind of a revelation for me many, many years ago was living in Central California, going to college at a college called Davis. And it was, they had this fog, early morning fog, tule fog. And in the wintertime, the cold fog was really cold. And I didn't have any gloves, and I would bike to school, and the first 5-10 minutes of being in class, I couldn't actually use my pen because my hand was still frozen, and so it was so cold. So I used to, for a while, I was biking to school this way and kind of feeling miserable, sorry for myself, and it was so terrible, this cold that I felt. And then at one point, I kind of had a memory that exactly the same feeling of cold that I was having biking to school was, as far as best of my memory, exactly the same feeling of cold I had in my fingers as a kid when I used to go skiing. And that skiing, it was exhilarating. It was fun. It was fantastic. It was part of the richness of the whole experience. And I realized that... that how I was experiencing the same sensation varied depending on the interpretation I had it, the context I put on it, the ideas I had about it. And after that, biking didn't become so difficult anymore. I realized that I was adding something to the experience of cold. I was adding self-pity, and this is going to be tough and hard, and I don't know what I was adding exactly. And then it became just more matter of fact and simple to have the cold. It was still cold and a little bit painful, but I didn't complicate it so much with all the ideas that were kind of subconscious almost. I didn't really realize how much I was doing. I thought it was just the cold. The cold was the cold, was painful, was bad. But we contribute to the experience. We have interpretations, meaning-making, predictions of what it means. We have self-referential feelings about it. This means that I, you know, maybe have self-pity about things that are difficult or self-congratulations for things that are good. And these inner movements of the mind may be very subtle. We don't necessarily see them. But they are kind of helping to shape our experience and to give kind of the totality, the gestalt of it. As we practice mindfulness, we can start teasing apart the different component elements that are all glommed together. We can see that self-pity is self-pity. It's different than the cold. We can see that the way that we're worried about the future that comes, pulls into my experience of cold, for example, is just my thoughts about the future. And we begin kind of teasing apart all this, the component elements. And as we do that, we begin actually freeing the mind. We begin, rather than glomming on or focusing on it, then we begin to free it, because not only is our experience, you know, like for example, me of the cold, partly shaped by my relationship to it, but it's also shaping how I might experience the mind. The mind gets contracted, it gets tight, it gets small. The mind gets hot, agitated, and you can, the inner mood, the state of mind that we have, shifts and changes also, depending on what we're focusing on and how we're focusing on it in relationship to things. So we're also, in a sense, shaping how we experience the mind or how the mind can be felt. Whether that's the mind itself, who knows what the mind is, but how we experience the mind is what we're really working with in this practice here. And so the mind is also being shaped. And the language of the early tradition is that the concepts we are focusing on, fixating on, creates limits, creates a boundary to the mind, an edge to the mind. But as we stop focusing so much on the things and our preoccupations and all this activities of the mind, the activities of the mind get quieter and quieter, the shape, the way which we kind of shape the feeling of the mind, the sense of the mind, begins to lose its edges, its coagulation, its contraction, its gathering together, and it becomes more open, more spacious, and after a while, it can almost feel like there's no boundaries to the mind or no boundaries to awareness or no boundaries to the state that we're in. And to use a little bit dangerous word from what I said earlier, no boundaries to consciousness. And it isn't so much, again, important what all these words point to. The wonderful thing is the experience of no more edges, no more boundaries. And the mind starts feeling large, great, expansive, wide. And this is one of the things that can be experienced as we deepen this meditation practice, is the mind becomes expansive, becomes wide. In Zen, they called it a big mind, as opposed to the small mind. The expansive mind rather than the contracted mind. The more expansive it gets, the calmer it becomes, the less agitated it is. In the similar that space, empty space, you know, kind of has no agitation. And they say that that the mind becomes similar to space. So less and less agitation and calm. It also helps make the mind more malleable and shapeable. Because when we're really fixated on something, the mind becomes hard, maybe even brittle, and kind of fixated also. And if you do the same habit of mind over and over and over again for decades, the mind gets kind of locked into being a particular way. It's hard to soften it. But with meditation, enough time, it begins to soften and relax, and it becomes malleable and shapeable. And one of the ways the mind can be then more, what happens when the mind becomes more shapeable or malleable or soft and is it's easier and easier to train the mind. It's easier and easier to get the mind focused and centered, settled. And that allows for some of the more beautiful qualities of the mind to shine. The mind that's fixated and bounded and limited by its agitation and preoccupation doesn't really allow for the luminosity of the mind to show itself. The clarity of the mind, the mind that feels clean, the mind that feels bright. So this gestalt, this wide sense of the attitude of mind, the state of mind, the mood of mind, the quality of awareness, that is so wide that it includes all things, and it includes our suffering. Not to deny it, but to give it a very different context than if our relationship is like a locked on to our suffering. And it's possible to suffer of different kinds and not lock on, and to feel the suffering being held or existing in this much wider, broader context has a certain kind of ease or calm that also allows to have compassion for suffering. There's space for friendliness and care for it that's maybe more difficult when we're locked into it. So there's a lot of benefits to discovering mindfulness of the mind. And for Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing practice, we train ourselves to breathe with the mind. Breathing in when one experiences the mind. Breathing out when experiences the mind. And as always with this Anapanasati, this rhythm of breathing in and breathing out is meant to keep us from getting fixated on anything, including fixated on the mind. So they just stay fluid and relaxed kind of with the breathing. Breathing in with the mind, breathing out with the mind. How about taking care of one's body by getting mittens or wool socks over hands? These days I bike down with mittens on my hands, with gloves. I just was not smart enough when I was a college student for that even to occur to me. I didn't have gloves and never passed my mind. So some of us, it takes a while to become wise about how to take care of ourselves. But in the meantime, I got a very good lesson from my story with my cold hands. So thank you very much.